today on Against the Grain was the torture committed by U.S. personnel after 9/11. Was it unprecedented, as many have claimed? Alexa Koenig says no. She says police in the U.S. routinely employed torture in the early 20th century. I'm C.S., the director of the Human Rights Center at UC Berkeley, joins me to discuss the history of what's called the third degree, coming right up. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. According to Alexa Koenig, the post-9/11 use of torture by U.S. interrogators and the tacit sanctioning of torture by U.S. officials are not new. Torture was practiced widely and routinely in the U.S., she has written, by police officers in the opening decades of the 20th century. What was known as the third degree, a cluster of practices that included the torture of criminal suspects, was commonly used until popular opinion, and even the opinion of some police officials, turned against it in and around the 1930s. What Alexa Koenig and University of San Francisco law professor Richard Leo have done in a new volume called Confronting Torture is tell the history of the third degree and examine how understanding that history might aid efforts to end the use of torture today. Alexa Koenig is executive director of the Human Rights Center and lecturer in residence at UC Berkeley School of Law. The full title of the volume in which her and Richard Leo's chapter appears is Confronting Torture: Essays on the Ethics, Legality, History, and Psychology of Torture Today. The volume is edited by Scott Anderson and Martha Nussbaum. When Alexa joined me in studio, I asked her what we should know about torture committed by U.S. personnel during the so-called War on Terror, and especially in the first few years after 9/11.
Well, in the years following 9/11, I think we didn't know much about what was taking place in response to the War on Terror, at least at black sites and other military detention facilities around the world. It wasn't until several years later, probably 2004, 2005, that information began to leak out to the public about the abusive handling of detainees in these different locations. But of course, once we did begin to find out what was going on, it shocked the world. So photos that were leaking from military sites, like at Abu Ghraib, and of course those pictures are now iconic and infamous, to understanding the indefinite detention during which different detainees were held at Guantanamo and other locations, which the UN has now declared to be a form of torture, to the abusive practices that have become really quite iconic, from leading people around on leashes to physical cruelty, such as beatings. We, of course, have had two detainees who were beaten to death quite notoriously, to the psychological handling of detainees that has been quite concerning to the international community.
Who do we know, what officials or contractors have done this? And in what locations? And we're talking about kind of, you know, U.S.-directed torture, U.S.-directed coercive interrogation.
So starting first with the locations, I think there have been a number of different sites during which torture has taken place. Perhaps most notorious is, of course, Guantanamo, which is based in Cuba. I think one of the issues that really distinguishes Guantanamo from some of the other locations is that many detainees who've since been released have said that that was more of a psychological prison, that the physical cruelties were less perpetrated there than sort of the psychological component of being told you would be held indefinitely, that you would never see your family again. And many of the men whom we've spoken to over the years have said that in many ways that was even harder to endure than the physical abuse that many of them had experienced in other locations. There are, of course, also military detention facilities that are quite broadly known in Iraq and Afghanistan. Most notorious of those have been Bagram and Kandahar. Many of the men who siphoned through Guantanamo were first at one of those two facilities or both. And those were the places where they were often stripped, held in very isolated conditions at times, really endured a number of stress positions, and even experienced some of the beatings that have since become known. The third sort of cluster of locations have been black sites, and those were locations that were not openly known to be holding detainees, but it wasn't revealed until many years later that these were secret prisons essentially around the world. And they really took place in a number of different locations. One of the most notorious was in Thailand, but we've also known that some detainees were rendered to places like Poland. Others were held on ships off in disparate oceans as a means to get them outside of domestic jurisdictions. In terms of the people, it's really varied from members of the FBI to members of the CIA. There was a clash at some of these different facilities that we now know about, where the FBI tended in general to argue in favor of using more traditional methods of interrogation, while the CIA tended to engage in practices that really stretched what we would traditionally and normally use to question people who are being held. And it was often the CIA who was directing a lot of the abuses that we now know about.
You write that according to many accounts of the post-9/11 use of torture by U.S. personnel, this torture is a dramatic break from the past. Do you agree with that?
No, actually, I don't. And I think that's one of the reasons why Richard and I wrote this chapter and have also worked on other pieces. It's been fascinating to see how many people who really do look at the history of torture or have looked at our reactions to 9/11 have really treated this as a period of time that was exceptional. And yes, while it was a pivotal time in American history, we have a long history of engaging in torture and in practices that became known domestically as the third degree that somehow really were not covered in detail by a lot of the people who were writing in the post-9/11 era. And I think that that ahistorical addressing of what we were going through as a country and as a broader international community, unfortunately, glosses over a lot of what we could be learning in past situations that could be informative or instructive for what we need to do now.
The third degree, it's a rather ominous euphemism. Who practiced it and where?
So the third degree is a euphemism for a physically abusive practices that we believe began in sort of the mid-19th century, so 1850s on, with the rise of policing here in the United States and the rise of sort of this prison complex that we now have today. The 1910s and 1920s were really considered the heyday of the third degree, a time period during which any lawlessness, quote unquote, was being dealt with increasingly difficult physical practices. But not only are we talking about torture when we're talking about the third degree, we're talking about an entire institutional way of responding to people who are seen as quote unquote bad people. So it might involve things like not charging people with a crime so that you can hold them beyond the limitations of how long you can traditionally hold someone once they've been charged. It may include siphoning people from prison to prison so that lawyers can't find them or family members can't find them until you get the kinds of answers that you're looking for. It may include both psychological and physical duress to try and coerce some form of confession, whether that confession is in fact based on the truth of what took place or not. In the 1910s and 1920s, you begin to see a number of investigative journalists who began to uncover what was happening in police stations around this country. And a growing concern among politicians and others about how we could begin to rein in some of these more abusive police practices, and in that way really strengthen the practice of the rule of law in the United States.
So the third degree comprised what interrogation techniques?
It ranged. Interrogation techniques under the third degree could be as physically abusive as slamming someone into walls or punching them, kicking them, chaining them up for long periods of time, suspending them from ceilings. Increasingly, though, you also saw the use of behaviors that would leave no marks. So the idea that you would find ways to keep bruising to a minimum while basically inflicting the maximum amount of harm to get people to do what you wanted them to do. So we have a lot of evidence now that people might, for example, line a sandbag with silk in order to mitigate the amount of bruising that the body could endure at the same time that you were doing things that were quite painful, or twisting arms behind backs or breaking fingers, for example, which was not as bloody as some of the other techniques that were being used, but was seen as quite effective, if you mean by effective getting people to say what you wanted them to say.
And the idea behind techniques that don't mark the skin is so that there's no evidence, right? nobody can prove, at least physically or by appearance, that they were tortured.
So Darius Rejali, who's done a lot looking at the history of torture, has noted that in Western democracies that hold up really highly the rule of law, you tend to see these kinds of torture practices that leave no marks, in part because you really need plausible deniability that torture in fact took place. Under our legal framework here in the United States, when information is gleaned through the use of torture, that information is supposed to be not admissible in court. And so one of the things that police officers had to do in order to get these forced confessions to be admissible was to basically show that these had been obtained in some way that was lawful. And of course, torture has been illegal throughout our history, in part under the Eighth Amendment to our Constitution, but also under international law, which has since been domesticated here in the United States.
So we have beatings, sometimes for hours, you write, and there was other violence, including with electricity.
That's correct. You might see electricity. People became very creative. And I think that's something that we've seen throughout history and throughout time is really how creative people can get. And there's something called force drift that we've seen throughout different locations and different time periods, where once someone begins to experiment with what you can do to put another human being through extraordinary pain, whether physical or psychological or a combination thereof, you'll begin to get more and more creative until the point where if in the beginning you thought, oh, I'm just going to make this a little uncomfortable for someone, you know, a month or two or three in, you see that you've slipped quite a long ways from discomfort to something that anyone would really see as egregious.
Alexa Koenig is her name. She's executive director of the Human Rights Center and lecturer in residence at UC Berkeley School of Law. And she co-authored with Richard Leo a chapter entitled Police Interrogation and Coercion in Domestic American History. It appears in a new volume called Confronting Torture, edited by Scott Anderson and Martha Nussbaum. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. What was the sweatbox and what was the water cure?
The sweatbox was a way to use high temperatures to make someone so uncomfortable that they would ultimately say or do anything in order to relieve the discomfort that they were experiencing. The water cure was really any of a combination of practices that led someone to feel as if they were drowning and induced the kind of panic that, again, would get them to do whatever you wanted them to do or say. So, and that could include things like holding someone's head underwater in a bucket until they began to choke and gasp. It could involve things that we would consider waterboarding today, so laying someone out on a board and basically flooding their nose and their mouth with water through a hose or through some other mechanism until, again, they really have the experience of choking and the sensation of drowning, which, of course, in fact, they are doing until you relieve that pressure.
And psychological methods, forms of psychological coercion that fell within the rubric of the third degree?
So psychological practices could be things like setting up almost a drama in the next room where you might shoot a gun and have someone scream or have a sudden thud to the floor in order to terrorize the particular detainee into thinking that he or she might be next and might be shot or killed, regardless of whether that in fact was taking place next door. You might have women screaming as if they were being raped or otherwise harmed. You might suggest to them, to the particular prisoner, that you had their family members in custody and would do far worse to those family members if that particular person didn't confess to whatever crime they were alleged to have committed. Certainly the use of children of that individual, saying that you were tracking them, watching them, or could otherwise bring them to harm. So it really varied from hurting one's loved ones to the threat of immediate killing or other abuse.
What was the police practice of losing the suspect?
So losing the suspect was a creative attempt by police to basically make it very difficult to find where a prisoner was located. This was particularly useful to the individual or to the police officers because the lawyers couldn't get hold of them Reporters couldn't report on what was taking place in this individual case. Family members couldn't find the individual, which of course was quite distressing, not only to the family members, but to the prisoner who felt that he or she had entered into sort of this unknown world. It could also mean shuttling them from police station to police station or putting them in private or hidden rooms so that they couldn't be found. So even if you had a police station that was, you know, publicly accessible, having secret places, you know, underground or to the side where these particular individuals could be held for long periods of time.
So if, as you say, the 1920s, 1910s were the heyday of the third degree, how widespread were the use of these coercive interrogation techniques? And also, to what extent did the police admit that they were using the third degree?
The police response to allegations of using the third degree have historically been fascinating because on the one hand, they've repeatedly said that they haven't been using the third degree, that they've been doing everything by the book. But on the other hand, they've made suggestions that they couldn't do their job effectively without roughing up particular prisoners. And as far as how widespread it was rampant throughout the United States. I don't think there are many jurisdictions that could claim to have been free of the third degree. What was going on in Chicago and to some extent in New York were some of the most notorious locations that we now know about. Also, of course, in the Deep South, we have stories that are quite horrific. But it really was rampant across the United States.
And just to be clear, was the third degree legal in the U.S.?
The third degree was not legal in the United States. It really is a euphemism for torture. And under the Eighth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, you're not allowed to basically step over the line into something that's abusive. And what we see with the third degree is it really is an encapsulation of very abusive psychological and physical practices.
I can't help but ask, Alexa, is this the origins of the euphemism, the third degree?
So it's a little unclear exactly where the term third degree originates. Some people have suggested it comes from Freemasonry and that the third degree reflects a third stage of practice that then eventually was adopted into policing. But over time, it began to take on the sort of layman's term that we think of with it today.
And what was the goal or objective of the police in using and applying the third degree?
Well, there were multiple goals. One was, of course, to resolve their case. So many police did seem to believe that abusive practices could lead to getting at the truth. I have no doubt that there were at least a handful that thought that that was possible. But there were some that needed to clear these particular cases from their books and probably either didn't care whether they were getting at the truth so long as they were closing their case or just had a reckless disregard for that fact. For others, though, if we look at the history of policing in the United States, it also was to exact punishment. If you're talking about a wrong being perpetrated in a small town, you might have a particular individual picked up, and it might be for any particular reason, bias, stereotypes about who is perceived as someone who might have done something wrong in that particular location. And that person might even become a proxy for social frustrations at the time, whether based on race, based on gender, et cetera. So, certainly punishment. It also became a way to just make work more expedient, to try and not have to go through the painstaking and methodical work of building a case from scratch, really getting the physical, the testimonial, and the documentary evidence needed to prove your case. Because if you got a confession, that really absolved you from having to do that quite laborious, time-consuming work.
So we focused almost entirely on police officers and them exacting this kind of punishment. What about prosecutors and judges and other actors within the criminal justice system? To what degree were they involved with or complicit in the third degree?
Judges, prosecutors, and others were largely complicit in the third degree, in part because the third degree, when it became a proxy for having to actually go through the laborious and time-consuming process of bringing a case to fruition, became a time saver for everybody. So for prosecutors who certainly wanted to protect their win rates, when that was basically the objective for many of them, it worked in their favor to work closely with the police to see if you could bring a case to resolution. resolution quickly and or develop some kind of plea bargain that would also be considered a win for the prosecutor. For judges, again, it really depended on the community in which this was taking place. There were some judges who we now know were bribed and who were very complicit in systems that we would really question the ethics and morality of today. I'm sure there were others who may have been largely ignorant or turned a blind eye toward what they knew were was happening in their particular jurisdiction.
So I think you mentioned that media members and other folks began to report on the third degree and expose its use and the prevalence of its use. So what did those reports, what did these exposés do to the way the public viewed and perceived police practice and the system as a whole?
The work of investigative journalists was invaluable to exposing a lot of the corruption in policing and some of the social problems that were driving a lot of the abuses that were taking place in police stations. So by exposing these stories and really showing the worst of the treatment, they were able to mobilize the public and generate an outcry against this particular cluster of practices. In 1931, that culminated in a report called the Wickersham Report, which is now very well known as being a very thorough investigation that was pulled together of policing across the United States. That 1931 report really signifies or signals a moment in time where things began to change. And I think by bringing a lot of these very dark practices up into the light, there began to be a growing understanding that we needed to adhere to the rule of law and to see how we could clean up our system to make sure that our adjudication of these cases really did result in the outcomes that they should be resulting from, because they were a little bit closer to the truth of what had taken place in all these different cases.
So what else happened besides media reports and this Wickersham report that came out, as you said, in 1931 to sort of build momentum toward doing away with the third degree, if that's in fact what happened?
Another thing that took place around the same time was a rise in the professionalization of policing. Policing in the 1910s, 1920s had been mostly a lower working class type of job. And as we get into the 1930s and 1940s, we really see this momentum where you see more middle class individuals entering that field of practice and really wanting to generate more respect for policing as an institution. So in order to generate that additional respect, it needed to look less like thuggery and a lot more like you were engaging in scientific methodologies that would garner that deep respect. You also, around the same time, see just in society more generally in the 40s and 50s, a growing commitment to the scientific method writ large. So you begin to see the design of lie detector systems, which of course have their problems, and we know a lot about their fallibility, but beginning to try and think through, could we use emerging technologies and could we use our understanding of science to find other ways to generate the facts that are needed to win cases in ways that are less fallible than, say, abusing particular individuals and coercing these confessions that were increasingly recognized as often being false?
So what happened to the third degree, let's say, after the 1930s?
The third degree largely went underground. It had been highly criticized by institutions in a growing and increasingly global society. You have the rise of the United Nations after World War II, who's beginning to critique the practices in a number of countries. And for the United States, the biggest blemish on our human rights record has consistently been our policing practices, our jail-based practices. So you really see the third degree drop off as sort of the routine, everyday way of handling cases. You see this rise of scientific methodologies. And while there will always be abuses in any kind of prison complex, any total institution where people are held isolated from others, it certainly dropped and no longer was the standard or the norm to which people subscribed.
That's Alexa Koenig, K-O-E-N-I-G. She directs the Human Rights Center at UC Berkeley, and she is co-editor of Extreme Punishment, Comparative Studies in Detention, Incarceration, and Solitary Confinement. And again, we are talking about an article she wrote with Richard Leo about police interrogation and coercion in domestic U.S. history. It appears in the new volume, Confronting Torture. I'm CS. We'll take a short break and speak more with Alexa, and we'll bring it more up to the present and talk about the parallels she and Richard have drawn between the third degree in the early 20th century and post 9/11 coercive interrogation techniques. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Alexa Koenig joins me. She is Executive Director of the Human Rights Center and Lecturer in Residence at UC Berkeley School of Law, where she teaches classes on human rights and international criminal law. And again, we are talking about a really interesting chapter that she and Richard Leo co-authored about police interrogation and coercion in domestic U.S. history, namely the third degree as practiced by U.S. police departments and officers beginning in the 19th century, although, as Alexa has told us, the heyday of the third degree was in the 1910s, 20s, and 30s. We kind of began this hour with you talking about post-9/11 torture and you telling us that it's not unprecedented in the way that many media accounts say it is, right? That this is an extraordinary new thing. So let's start drawing some parallels, if we could, between the third degree and post-9/11 interrogation. And maybe one way to begin is to talk about physical practices. So physical techniques directed toward detainees, what parallels do you see there?
When Richard and I started working on this chapter, we were really struck by how similar the methods were that were being revealed in the kind of the post-9/11 era from what he had been seeing and studying in terms of looking at domestic policing. So just at a very basic level, one of the methodologies post-9/11 that has really garnered quite a bit of attention is, of course, waterboarding. And that is something that we directly see coming up in domestic police stations back in the 10s and 20s, looking at how water was used as a way to induce the sense of suffocation and of drowning to basically induce people to say or do what you wanted them to. Another cluster of practices that was quite similar was just the physical abuses to which people were subject. So things like using electricity, hooking people up so that they would have electrical shocks running through their body. In the Abu Ghraib photos that are now so notorious and so infamous, you of course see a picture, there's that one that's particularly well known of an individual standing on a box with a hood on his head and electrical wires running off his fingertips. Well, in domestic policing, there was a practice where they would have individuals hold on to a metal bar and put another metal bar along their spine and then run an electrical current through their body. So that was another area where you see kind of the physical piece really playing out. You also saw a desire to have, again, the ability to deny that physical abuses had been perpetrated. So you see a lot of practices where the individual's or the detainee's own body is used against him or herself in ways that will mitigate bruising and other physical sequelae of torture. One example of that is just stringing people up from ceilings, which is incredibly painful over long periods of time. It dislocates their shoulders, et cetera, and keeps them from sleeping, which is also problematic in a number of different ways. Or harnessing people to the ground in a squatting position so that eventually their legs, you know, give out or start to shake. You see that in both the domestic context and also in the post-9/11 military context.
Tell us about the frequent flyer program and also parallels between extraordinary rendition in this so-called war on terror and what was done back during the time of the third degree.
So with extraordinary rendition in the post-9/11 era, you had different detainees who were not brought to U.S. jurisdiction for interrogation practices or for detention. You have individuals who were shuttled to other countries that were particularly known for abusive treatment of individuals. And the idea was to really outsource this practice of torture so that you had clean hands on the part of American service members, but you were still able to use torture as both forms of information gathering and also as a form of punishment for individuals who you believed to have done wrong against the United States. That practice meant that several detainees were shuttled to multiple different countries in a relatively short period of time. We now know that airplanes were used that often were not publicly, people were not publicly alerted to the fact that these flights were happening. There were a number of investigators who eventually figured out that certain planes were landing when there wasn't supposed to be a plane landing and began to track the numbers on the tail of those planes and began to piece together this rendition program. But it meant that things were happening quite secretively and sort of in the dark of night of shuttling people from one place to another. It also meant that attorneys like those at the Center for Constitutional Rights at the ACLU couldn't get a handle on exactly who had been detained in the post-9/11 era in order to represent them and to make sure that they were being held in ways that were consistent with the rule of law. This, of course, is very similar to what we saw earlier in the 20th century in terms of domestic policing, where you have police officers who wanted more time with their own detainees and their own prisoners before they were formally charged with any crime. And so they would shuttle these particular prisoners from location to location, sometimes moving them across state lines, in order to have more time outside of the reach of different attorneys and, of course, of the oversight of the public more generally.
Officials who approved and now defend the use of enhanced interrogation techniques, they make the argument that the kind of the uniqueness of the global war on terror, you know, the extraordinary circumstances to which the U.S. must respond, justifies the use of extraordinary techniques. What do you make of that argument?
So, as you mentioned, people have argued that we're in an extraordinary period of time, that the war on terror is unlike everything we've seen before. But we've actually have seen that before, and we saw that with the declared war on crime. Certainly back in the early part of the 20th century, one of the ways that these practices were justified was by saying that we were seeing a rise in criminality unlike anything we had ever witnessed previously, and that in order to keep people safe who were not, you know, quote-unquote evildoers, you needed to react to the harshness that people were seeing in society with particularly harsh behaviors. Now, of course, empirically, we don't have a strong sense of what works and what doesn't. We have anecdotal evidence that suggests particularly abusive practices ultimately lead people to say what you want them to say in order to get that torture to stop. Now, sometimes that might be accurate information, but it's also believed that the vast majority of the time it probably isn't. Because if you are, for example, taken into custody and you are not someone who has perpetrated a particular crime, there's no way that you can actually admit to that particular crime because it's impossible to admit to. And you realize, though, that the torture is only going to stop when you do confess. In the case of post-9/11 and looking at Guantanamo, the U.S. government alone has suggested that up to 90% of the individuals who are held at Guantanamo were never found guilty of any wrongdoing against the United States. And there's a number of reasons why people were picked up who really had no connection to terrorism. And I think while torture is not okay even when it's perpetrated against people who have committed horrific crimes, thinking about the scale of the ways that people were subjected to torture, if this 90% number is true and the vast majority of them were subjected to indefinite detention at a minimum, we're talking about having tortured large numbers, hundreds of people who in fact were not guilty.
Another lesson you write, another lesson we can glean from the history of the third degree, is that torture spreads, by which you mean?
Torture spreads in a number of different ways. One is in terms of the kinds of practices that are utilized. So, for example, the enhanced interrogation program that was initially authorized just for use at Guantanamo eventually migrated overseas to use at Kandahar, to Bagram, and to other locations, which makes a lot of sense. If you have prison guards who are migrating from one location to another, they're going to bring with them the practice that they know and that they understand. You also have leadership that migrated from one location to another. It also spreads, though, not only in terms of practices geographically, but it spreads in terms of how harsh those behaviors come. So when you find that certain egregious practices aren't working, you almost instinctually begin to experiment with other kinds of practices, or you expand upon the duration or the severity. For example, walling someone, shoving them against a wall doesn't seem to work. You might try hitting them or walling them in a condition where they're also subjected to extremely cold temperatures. Extreme cold temperatures are known to exacerbate the pain that you feel with any kind of physical torture, for example. So you've got that increase in how extreme things are. You also tend to see, though, that it spreads in terms of who it's used against. So while you might initially say, we're just going to use this against these two particular detainees who are known, quote unquote, bad actors, you eventually see that spread to more generalized populations. Historically and geographically, over time, we've seen it spread from saying you only use them with male prisoners to using them against women and to eventually using practices against children, categories of people who would normally be off limits for particularly severe abuse.
And you and Richard Leo also claim that torture corrupts. In what ways?
It corrupts in a few different ways. It corrupts the individual. I think that in looking over files that have since been leaked or revealed to the American public, you really see how at a loss a lot of people were in the post 9/11 era about what to do. And as they use torture, you see also how that ultimately blights their own appearance of professionalism, of legitimacy, and whether they are ultimately held legally accountable for that practice or not. You see how that often does go on to mar their career. And with good reason. The other way that it corrupts is it really corrupts societies. So it's something that tears apart the fabric of a nation. It creates great divides in terms of what is considered acceptable. One of the benefits of having a norm against torture and such clear parameters in international law and domestic law around appropriate behavior is that we can come together as a society to say certain kinds of behaviors are outside the norm of what we consider acceptable for a whole range of reasons, both ethical, ranging from the ethical to the pragmatic. So that sense of corruption as a society, I think there are a number of people and a number of countries who now question the United States' moral leadership on the global stage. We were for so many years seen as the leader in terms of human rights, and I think that's a claim that has slipped significantly over the past 15 to 20 years.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Alexa Koenig joins me. She directs the Human Rights Center at UC Berkeley, where she is lecturer in residence. She is co-author of Hiding in Plain Sight, The Pursuit of War Criminals from Nuremberg to the War on Terror. And she co-authored a chapter with USF law professor Richard Leo. It's a chapter about police interrogation and coercion in domestic American history. And you can find that chapter in the new volume, Confronting Torture. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. You and Richard Leo devote a section of this chapter to kind of ways out of the current conjuncture, at least the post 9/11 coercive interrogation technique regime. Accountability is an important one for the two of you. How important is accountability, holding torturers and those who empower them accountable, to ending the practice?
Accountability is critical to ending torture, in part because if we're not able to support our legal frameworks with some, teeth, then it ultimately becomes incumbent upon every individual the extent to which they're going to adhere to those norms or not. And I do think it sends not only a message to that individual, but to the international community at large that we're not hypocrites, that we're willing to stand up for the legal practices that we say are correct and to acknowledge when we have slipped outside of those frameworks of what's right and what's wrong. We have not, unfortunately, seen accountability to any great extent in terms of what we now know to have happened in the post 9/11 era. Where we have seen accountability, that's also, though, been problematic. So if we look at Abu Ghraib as an example, and the original seven people who were held accountable for the abuses perpetrated there, the vast majority of them were relatively low-lying individuals. And our system of accountability is really set up to go after the people who are most responsible for that. And we don't often see that as the trigger pullers on the ground or the people who are perpetrating the abuses directly, but the people who are either commanding that those practices take place or who know those practices are taking place and fail to do anything to stop them or to hold people responsible for them. And so, at least under international law, but arguably domestic law as well, we really have failed to hold the highest level leaders responsible for a regime that was really of their own design and their own making.
What about changes in interrogation techniques? What, you know, how would you respond to somebody who says, well, how else are we going to get information that's reliable and truthful and accurate and that actually helps investigators, law enforcement, the FBI do its job?
One of the classes that I teach with a colleague, Eric Stover, at UC Berkeley is looking at human rights and war crimes investigations. And a basic element of that is that you always want three kinds of information to make up a good investigation. You need physical evidence, you need documentary evidence, and you need testimonial evidence. So what people are going to say about what happened. Unfortunately, I think when we get to the side of using these enhanced interrogation practices or torture, we're over-relying on testimonial evidence without necessarily having the physical and documentary information that you want in order to corroborate the testimonial piece of what you've got and ultimately triangulate your facts. So I think over-relying on torture means you're actually conducting a very poor investigation if that's coming at the expense of these other categories of information that we know are so critical to building strong cases. The other thing that we often teach at UC Berkeley is this idea of going into any investigation with multiple working hypotheses. And the idea behind multiple working hypotheses is that you don't have any one hypothesis about what has actually happened, who did what to whom and when and how. And I think, unfortunately, the justification for torture in the post-9/11 era has been that we got the quote-unquote bad guys and we're only using those techniques against them to elicit what we already know to have happened. But that's really going in with a set understanding of the facts that maybe are not factual. And ultimately, what we found in studying interrogations and investigations more generally is that what you tend to see happen is confirmation bias takes over. So that any little piece of information that you glean through using these abusive practices, you're going to see as feeding into your hypothesis and confirming that you were right. And when people give contrary facts or contrary information, you just immediately discount that as being wrong. And so you're not actually managing to stay outside of those set of facts and look at them objectively, but you've subjectively begun to pervert the investigation's process.
What might happen to harsh interrogation practices as war on terror cases begin to be tried, if it's true that they begin to be tried, in U.S. domestic courts as opposed to military tribunals?
Where these cases are tried is obviously a critical issue. Because our domestic court system does not allow information that's elicited through torture to come in as evidence, a lot of the cases of even now known terrorists are very difficult to actually adjudicate in our domestic court system. So in many ways, we've actually undermined our own ability to get accountability for crimes that have been perpetrated around the globe because we've perverted that whole system and now have to act outside that regime because we chose to do so from the outset. So one of the things we saw in the post-9/11 era is really from 2000 to 2003 on up until about 2015 is a tug of war that was taking place between the United States judiciary, the legislative branch, and the executive branch around who would actually have control over who got to hear the stories of the men who were being held in detention in these disparate facilities and what regime they would be subject to when trials did start happening. It's why we've seen this push for military trials as opposed to actually using what are known as our Article III judicial courts, the domestic courts that we know here in the United States, because there is a little bit more leeway in that military system around what facts are ultimately revealed to the public. But from just a rule of law perspective, our democracy really is founded on some degree of transparency. And I think until we are able to hear several of these cases in our domestic courts, we really won't have a good understanding of what happened on 9/11 and afterward.
So what was the Brown versus Mississippi case? And I understand that had something to do with the decline of the third degree in the U.S. And Are there other case law developments, recent case law developments, perhaps on the Supreme Court level, that will have maybe a similar impact to Brown versus Mississippi on the use of coercive interrogation techniques today?
So Brown versus Mississippi was a milestone in our domestic system that really helped to eliminate the third degree as an acceptable form of practice. In terms of today, there are a number of Supreme Court cases that have happened post 9/11 that basically underscored the ability of detainees to have a chance to bring habeas corpus cases, for example, in domestic courts. Habeas corpus cases are basically those where you say a government entity is wrongfully holding you and denying you of the basic due process to which you're entitled in order to challenge that detention. This was huge because one of the biggest issues from a torture perspective is that indefinite detention, as I mentioned earlier, is seen as a form of torture in and of itself under the United Nations system. So to hold people for years on end, for decades on end, with no hope of release is an abuse of power that has to be somehow challenged. And the way that you challenge it is through our Article III courts. Ultimately, over time, detainees have won that right to bring habeas cases in court systems here in the United States. And that's arguably the beginning of really trying to bring the rule of law back into this entire system post 9/11.
How much research has been done and needs to be done into the efficacy of interrogation techniques?
Very little has been done in terms of the big picture, and I think quite a bit more does need to be accomplished. Most of what we know around the efficacy of different interrogation practices is known through anecdotal evidence, so the stories that people tell after they're released from prison. It's very hard to figure out, though, how to do the kind of systematic empirical work that would give us valid information around what works and what doesn't in terms of eliciting the truth. It's problematic in first because from an ethical review board perspective, you can't exactly torture people in order to see whether torture works or not. So the only way that you're going to do that is through some kind of natural experiment where torture is already being used. But we won't often know where torture is being used because it is, in fact, illegal. And so it's often underground and people don't talk about it. But there are a number of reasons beyond efficacy to argue that torture should be discarded as a technique. And I think it's that set that maybe we need to turn our focus to and really think through. So there's the pragmatic piece that you're suggesting. But then there's also the ways that government, I mean, what kind of a society do we want to live in? What is the relationship of individuals to governments? How much power should governments have vis-a-vis individuals who have not yet been tried or convicted in a court of law? I think once they're convicted, there's a whole other set of questions that ultimately raises as well. But one of the real symbols of the United States has been the idea that the government is subject to the will of the people and not the reverse. So holding our government to task and setting clear boundaries around what is considered permissible and not is a really important concept on which our country's been founded.
So given that torture is often practiced, as you say, underground, right, out of sight, so that the public doesn't know about it, I mean, how do we even have a sense of the extent to which torture is practiced by U.S. personnel or their proxies? And how would we even be able to verify if torture were in fact ended?
That's a really good question. I don't think that we ever will know whether torture has ended. I think it's impossible. It's impossible to know. It's also impossible that it will ever be gone completely. I think human beings have a gut instinct that when they're angry or when they're scared, that they will often turn to abusive practices and see that as a very gut instinct way to respond. The reason we have a system of law, though, is so that we don't respond from a gut level. I think we now know from psychologists and psychiatrists and the research that has been done that our guts are often wrong and they're often based on bias. They're often confused by context. So the idea behind our legal frameworks is to step us out of that, have a systematic way of approaching problems to get at the truth and to handle moments in times of crisis. Unfortunately, 9/11 was one of the worst crises of the modern era, and we responded in very predictable ways out of fear. and unfortunately failed to rely on our laws, a very strong set of laws under our Constitution, domestic criminal law, international criminal law, that I think would have really avoided many of the problems that we're dealing with today in terms of not being able to adjudicate these cases and also responding to the international community around the torture that we perpetrated as a community.
And you are Executive Director, Alexa, of the Human Rights Center. Tell us about the center and its activities.
Human Rights Center is about to hit its 25th year on the UC Berkeley campus. We are an independent research and training center that operates in partnership with UC Berkeley, but we're financially independent, so we're based almost entirely on individual donations and foundation gifts. What that allows us to do is really look at where do we need a better empirical understanding of what's happening relative to human rights problems around the world so that we have some basis for making smart law and policy about next steps that need to take place. We work on issues as diverse as sexual violence and conflict, so helping governments figure out how to better prevent and respond to sexual violence, to health and human rights, so particularly right now looking at the refugee crisis and how do we keep refugee populations as healthy as possible, to thinking through how emerging technology in our tech and human rights program can be harnessed to really improve human rights investigations. We have a new project that was co-founded in 2016, which now brings students together from across UC Berkeley. We have students from 22 majors, and they speak collectively 31 languages. And what we're doing is partnering with nonprofit groups like Amnesty International, the Syrian Archive, et cetera, to figure out how to use social media to build war crimes cases for both advocacy and legal accountability for the wrongs that we're seeing right now in Myanmar and Syria, et cetera. What's been super exciting is having these students really pioneer cutting-edge methods about how you can glean information from social media about what's happening in very faraway places, and then verify that content so it can be relied upon by courts, so it can be relied upon by other NGOs, that they can build what they need to say about what's happening in those very disparate parts of the world. It's also combating, to some extent, the fake news phenomenon, because we have a team of students who are really understanding just how frequently fake information is promulgated on the internet, and giving them the basic skills about how to check their facts so they know what to share and what not to.
We'll put a link on againstthegrain.org to the Human Rights Center at UC Berkeley so you can learn more about what it's doing and how you might support its activities. And we'll also put a link to the volume Confronting Torture, edited by Scott Anderson and Martha Nussbaum, in which you can find the chapter on police interrogation and coercion in U.S. history that my guest Alexa Koenig has co-authored with Richard Leo, and also a link to the book that Alexa has co-authored. It's Hiding in Plain Sight, The Pursuit of War Criminals from Nuremberg to the War on Terror. Alexa Koenig, pleasure meeting you. Keep up the great work, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.